you're tuned to Truth News Radio, and it's the 2nd of October 2013. I'm so glad you could join us today. My name's Hereward Fenton. For the next 2 hours, we'll be going through some international news, and I have a very important interview in the second hour with a lady who joins us from Syria. I'm going to be speaking to Sarah, who is in Syria, and I'm going to be asking her some very serious questions based on my recent research and exploration into information that's been percolating up about the Syrian chemical weapons attack, which took place in August. There is increasing evidence, folks, that these chemical weapons attacks were indeed a false flag, and worse. It just gets worse. The Syrian chemical weapons attack, which killed up to 1,400 people, many of them children, took place in an area which had been largely evacuated. Now, at the same time as these attacks occurred, it turns out that a number of children had gone missing from Alawite villages in other parts of Syria. And some of the children that have been seen in the videos have been identified as these kidnapped children. What this appears to indicate is that the chemical weapons attacks were not just a false flag attack, they were a staged murder of hostages who were children, who were kidnapped from Alawite families. It takes the whole concept of this false flag to a new level of barbarity. And I have to say, I'm not absolutely sure about this. I'm certainly not convinced. I don't know. But the suggestion is so disturbing that it has to be investigated further. Now, of course, as the attention of the mainstream is now turned towards the breakthrough in diplomacy and the weapons teams that are going to supervise the destruction of Syrian chemical weapons, I think what's going to happen is that the story about the massacre in Ghouta is going to gradually fade from our awareness. And like many of the stories we've heard out of Syria that blame the government, it seems to lack in substance, those who are trying to use it as propaganda, those who are trying to push it, are going to gradually back away from it, and they'll simply just stop talking about it. But that's why it's all the more important that we continue to look at it, because this show is about defeating propaganda. It is about probing into the realities and deliberately confronting the spin and the lies that are used in the mainstream. So I would like to continue, and I would like to get people on this show who can talk to us about what really happened on that day, but also the general atmosphere in Syria, the general feeling that people have towards their government. This is an extremely important question. Because again, the endless, ceaseless machine of propaganda tells us that in Syria that they have a terrible government, a terribly brutal regime, and that the people there just hate it, and that the rebels actually represent the will of the people. Now, all the real evidence that I've seen does not suggest that at all. What it suggests is that, sure, there are elements who are against the government, but there is also huge, broad support of the government, even across different ethnic groups, even across different Islamic sects and Christians. The government has broad support, but of course, there is an insurgency. there are foreigners who have come into the country there, who are being paid, who are being supplied with guns, who are being supplied with weapons of various kinds, perhaps even chemical weapons, whose job it is to destabilize the regime. So I will be raising questions about that and also about the weapons attacks and the allegations that the children were actually kidnapped hostages with my guest in the second hour. So I do hope you can join us for that hour. It's going to be a really interesting discussion. Now, in the first hour of today's show, I've got a few stories I would like to cover with you. I would like to talk a little bit about environmentalism and climate change. Last week, I went into quite a long kind of diatribe about the connections between early forms of environmentalism and fascism in Germany. And I found that information to be a real eye-opener. It certainly gives you a bigger and a broader perspective on what environmental movements really represent, what they are intrinsically. Today I want to talk a little bit about another aspect of the modern environmental movement, which is tied to climate change, but it's a little bit off to the side. I want to talk about sustainability, and I want to talk specifically about biofuels. Because, of course, the global biofuels market is absolutely enormous. And again, it only has its existence through very, very strong government intervention and mandates in terms of both tax exemptions and mandates to supply a certain percentage of fuel from what they call sustainable or renewable sources. So I want to get into that in some more detail because I want to highlight the fact that the biofuels, which have been the cause of tremendous problems around the world and which are gradually, it's gradually becoming very clear, are both environmentally destructive and are causing food shortages and even deaths, starvation, in large numbers. Not trivial. We're talking about serious effects on people's nutrition around the world. And of course, the biofuels phenomenon is linked to the climate change phenomenon because, and still, it still is sold this way to the general populations, and I've been looking at information on that, because it is said that biofuels are a low carbon footprint alternative. But of course, even that's disputed, even by those who agree with greenhouse anthropogenic warming. Even the strong supporters of that are actually disputing that biofuels are a low-carbon alternative. But it doesn't matter, folks. The machine of the corporatist engine of quote, environmentalism, unquote, cannot be stopped. It doesn't matter what you think. It's the same with CSG. CSG is good for the environment too, apparently, because it's low-carbon footprint. You see, it doesn't even matter what greenies say anymore. They just get dragged along. Oh, no, you're coming along with this. It's good for you because you agreed earlier on that we had to reduce carbon emissions. And guess what? You know, this does the job. Oh, but no, it doesn't. Shut up, right? Doesn't matter anymore. That's the corporatist fascist approach. So, again, it's another example of the corporatist fascist mechanism in action under the banner of environmentalism. Quite fascinating. Now, another story I want to cover with you today is a film that I had a chance to watch. And I'll be getting into that later on in the hour. But it is a film about the infiltration of activists in a style which can only be really properly described as COINTELPRO, although that's a term that dates from the 1960s. But this is a very recent story from the last decade. The film is titled Informant, and it is about a man by the name of Brandon Darby, who started out as an activist, with a kind of anarchist bent, helping people and organizing a collective in New Orleans after the cyclone there. In Australia, we call them cyclones. In the US, you call them hurricanes. But he became, gradually over time, he morphed into an FBI informant. But it's more interesting than that. Not only was he an informant, he was grooming activists to engage in what could only be described as terrorist-type activities, so he could then feed them to the FBI to make high-profile busts. Absolutely fascinating and chilling story. But first, let's return to the Syrian conflict. I want to play to you a clip from a recent Corbett report from James Corbett, in which he summarized the current state of knowledge about the chemical attacks and the purported abductions and the connection there between what happened and the missing children. So I'm just going to play that to you now, and I probably won't play the whole report, but we'll play a few minutes of it, and then I'll give you some more analysis of my own.
Now, new evidence is emerging that the attacks were used and manipulated by the terrorists in order to provoke the US and its allies into armed intervention in Syria. This evidence suggests that the video used by the US and its allies to conclude what happened in Ghouta was in fact carefully staged managed to portray a narrative that would pin the blame for the attacks on Assad. The first indications of this plot emerged early on, when expert analysis of the video suggested inconsistencies in the footage itself.
There are, within some of the videos, examples which seem a little hyper-real and almost as if they've been set up, which is not to say that they are fake, but it does cause some concern.
That analysis was later expanded on by a report from iSteams, a Syria-based human rights group working in conjunction with the International Institute for Peace, Justice, and Human Rights. In this thorough report, published on globalresearch.ca on September 16th, numerous discrepancies and inconsistencies in the footage are documented. The report documents through eyewitness testimony and video evidence that the affected areas had been largely abandoned by local residents in the days prior to the attack. Yet in the footage of the aftermath, there are large numbers of child victims who are betrayed. There exists very little footage of parents with their children, and what little footage exists portrays some of the parents apparently discovering their children on multiple occasions in different locations. Other footage shows the same children arranged in different formations in geographically distant neighborhoods. The report concludes that the footage was carefully stage-managed to create the greatest emotional impact on foreign audiences. These videos were then used by the Obama administration to convince the Senate of their case for military intervention. iSteam's president and one of the key researchers on the report, Mother Agnes Miriam, joined the Corbett Report to discuss the problems with the official narrative of the chemical weapons attack emanating from Washington and its allies last month.
Just pause it there. You're with Truth News Radio. I'm playing to you a clip there from the Corbett Report investigating the chemical weapons attacks in Syria. I'll be back after the break. It's great to be talking to you today. Please stay with us.
Are you getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free.
Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. It's great to have your company today. You're listening to an Australian-made broadcast, which is also available as a podcast, which you can download and which you can also get on iTunes, and or you can get on your mobile phone just by going to the RSS feed links which we provide on the site. And we've got several years of broadcasts there for you to peruse at your leisure. And we do a lot of interviews on this show. And, of course, today, being no exception, we have a really exceptional and original interview coming up in the second hour with a lady who joins us from Damascus in Syria. I'm currently going through a story that was explored in depth on the Corbett Report a couple of weeks ago, which derives from an independent assessment report that was done in Syria that indicates that the Syrian chemical weapons attacks were actually staged and manipulated. It really is a very, very disturbing allegation. And if you think back to events like, you know, the precursor to the invasion of Iraq 1, when the demonstration there in front of the UN about the babies being pulled out of incubators was used, this is along similar lines. However, this is not just a fake story. These children really died, right? And it really was horrific. And large numbers of them were killed. We don't know for sure whether it really was the 1,400 figure which has been quoted. But evidence is accumulating that some of the children depicted in these videos had been previously kidnapped by the rebel groups and that were used in this staged event. And we know the rebel groups have a special ops and CIA on the ground in there with them. And, you know, it's a little bit too diabolical and devious a thing, I think, for the locals to have thought up themselves. I just tend to think it comes straight from Langley, Virginia. It just has the full taste and flavour of CIA black ops, doesn't it? I mean, isn't that incredible? Isn't that chilling to think that they do that? Of course, we know they do it. I mean, we've seen examples of it so many times, again and again and again. But every time it comes up, you stand there aghast. You think, this can't be real. You know, supposedly normal tax-paying citizens of a democracy are facilitating this level of atrocity and this level of deception? How can it be? I don't know. I'm merely the messenger. I find it as incredible, and my cognitive dissonance is huge on this. You know, I really have great difficulty believing that normal human beings could do such a thing. Of course, my problem is that I'm considering them to be normal human beings, but they look like normal human beings, and there's the problem. Anyway, let's continue with the excerpt here from the Corbett Report, and then I'll read to you from an article which was published in Global Research on the same topic. We're just getting into an interview here which is done with a lady from Syria who has been involved in authoring that report.
I was in Damascus, and not very far. We were, you know, just near
Mother Agnes
the hotel
Miriam,
where the Commission of Inquiry for Chemical Weapons has just arrived. So from this to the Abbasin Square and to Jobar, you don't have flying, bird flying, more than 2 kilometers. How is it possible, you know, for a chemical weapon to be blown up and not to have any smell, not to have anything? Second, everybody, you know, began to ask this terrible question. How is it possible that in a neighborhood like Jobar or like Ghouta al-Sharqiyya, where you have a conflict, deadly conflict, running on since the months, it is, you know, in the frame of the big Damascus battle, neighborhoods, you know, they barely have any civilians. Why? Because they are destroyed, okay? And if they are not destroyed, the civilians, especially with the beginning of the counter-attack of the army, because the army had counter-attacks, I think the 21st or the 20th. We don't know why and how you had so many civilians in one place. Second, how is it possible in vacation and in such a, you know, frame where families are scattered, barely you have civilian living there, how is it possible that you have so many children together? This is, you know, scary. So did they gather them? Why? And you see them all together, and we ask for an inquiry. Why? Because we want to know who gathered those children and who killed them. Okay? Second, we have heard in the same day, because it was before our eyes, more than 40 ambulances of the army coming out from those outskirts to the hospital in Mezde. And we have been told that they were soldiers that were suffocated by the gas, by chemicals. So what is the truth, okay?
The iSteams report raises many troubling questions about the scenes in the Ghouta videos. Were the victims of the attack local children? If so, why were they there after these areas had been largely abandoned? Where are their parents? In the days after the attack, Dr. Boutaina Shaban, an advisor to the Assad government, provided an equally troubling answer to these questions to Sky News.
They kidnapped the children and men from the villages of Latakia, and they brought them here, put them in one place, and used chemical weapons against them. That's the story that the villagers in these villages know.
Okay, I'll just leave it there. That gives you a general summary of what the suspicions are in relation to the staging of that attack. There is another article which I'll draw to your attention, which is on globalresearch.ca, which goes into more of the detail on that topic. And the title of that article is The Ghouta Chemical Attacks, US-Backed False Flag, Killing Syrian Children to Justify a Humanitarian Military Intervention. Mother Agnes Mariam de la Croix, author of the controversial IS Teams report, is quoted as saying that the chemical attacks could be the most horrific false flag operation in history. And of course, it goes into here into the failures of the UN investigation and the cosmetic veneer of Swedish neutrality by the investigator Professor Åke Sällström. And it gets into more and more details there, which are extremely important. I'll just read to you very briefly here from the summary findings of the study. From the moment when some families of abducted children contacted us to inform us that they recognized the children among those who are presented in the videos as victims of the chemical attacks of East Ghouta, we decided to examine the videos thoroughly. Our first concern was the fate of the children we see in the footage. The angels are always alone in the hands of adult males that seem to be elements of armed gangs. If the studied footages were edited and published to exhibit pieces of evidence to accuse the Syrian state of perpetrating the chemical attacks on East Ghouta, our discoveries incriminate the editors and actors of forged facts through a lethal manipulation of unidentified children. Now, I don't really have time to get into that in any more detail, but I will be raising questions about this with my guest in the second hour, so do stay tuned for that. I hope that as time goes by, I hope that this story does not gradually recede and just vaporize like some of the other stories of massacres that we've seen. I mean, there was the famous the Hula massacre from last year, which was not a gas attack. It was like a knife attack. And after the evidence proved to be unsubstantiated for the Syrian government involvement, they stopped talking about it. We're going to continue talking about it. You're with Truth News Radio. Don't go away. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. Well, let's turn now to another subject. I want to talk a little bit about biofuels. The reason why I want to talk about biofuels is because this has now become the next big thing and the next, what I would say, act of environmental destruction, which is being engaged in by the global corporatist empires in the name of environmentalism. I actually had an opportunity to watch a documentary about the horrendous effects of biofuels recently, and I don't actually have the name of it. It just came up on the cable TV I was watching. But what I know is that it is causing a whole suite of problems. Let me just actually run through with you some of the aspects of the problems that have been created by biofuels. We have environmental destruction, and this is the actual the crops, the way, in fact, the monoculturing of biofuel crops and the dispossession of local landholders. So we've got the environmental destruction. We've also got land grabbing, which is taking place on a huge scale in Indonesia, and it's really, really wrecking people's lives in places like Sumatra and Kalimantan in Indonesia. It's also creating inflated fuel and energy prices, and this is because the biofuel subsidized energy sources are more expensive. So the price of fuel and the price of electricity in a country like Germany, which is now using biofuels a lot, even for the generation of power, is going up and up and up. That's actually hurting people in Europe. Then, of course, we've got the outright criminal scams. And these are scams that manipulate the markets and manipulate the measures that governments put in place to support the biofuel industry through just outright criminal actions. And I do have some articles on that which I will try to dig up. If not, I will put them on the show notes. The final thing, and the most serious, the one which I really want to concentrate our attention on today, is, of course, food shortages and mass death, because that is the ultimate result of food shortages. I have a quote here from an article, Hunger, Food Security and the African Land Grab, which was published in policyinnovations.org. Now let me just read to you this chilling quote. In a report published in the Journal of American Physicians and Surgeons, Dr. Indore Goklani estimates that the increase in biofuels production may be responsible for as many as 200,000 deaths per year from hunger and hunger-related illnesses. He argues that this massive shift in land use has decreased the amount of food available for human consumption and consequently raised the prices of vital staples. There are now millions who can no longer afford to buy these staples in sufficient quantities. Now, the country that is doing the most to advance biofuels is actually Germany. Germany has a policy that has involved both tax exemptions and mandates. And I've got a quote here from an article on that topic. In the initial phase of government support to biofuels, the German government granted extensive tax exemptions for biofuel in order to ease their introduction to the fuels market. The objectives for supporting the biofuels industry were to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and help improve long-term security of energy supply. The adoption of the Energy Tax Act meant a change in the policies adopted by the German government. From the 1st of August 2006 onwards, the German government introduced a partial tax on vegetable-based fuel With the implementation of the Biofuel Quota Act on January 1, 2007, Germany adopted a mandatory biofuel blending target for the mineral oil industry. And of course, we have that in many other countries. We have, I believe, in Australia, mandates coming in. Biofuels are now virtually guaranteed to be in all fuel that you buy at the pump, and it makes it more expensive, folks, and it also makes it less efficient for your engine. And the incredible thing here is that this whole scheme, this whole revolution in fuel has been prompted by the belief, as it says here, that doing so would reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Now, of course, we've stated on the show our skepticism about the anthropogenic greenhouse gas theory anyway, but I could cite you dozens of mainstream environmentalists, studies, well documented, that say that biofuels in fact increase greenhouse gas emissions. So, I mean, it's just quite incredible, isn't it? I mean, let me bring to your attention the Palm Oil Action website. Of course, palm oil being one of the major sources of biofuels, and it is grown extensively in Indonesia. And, of course, it is causing destruction of habitats. Many animals are being killed, and many people are being driven off their lands. Palm oil as a biofuel. Why palm oil should not be used as a biodiesel. As the burning of fossil fuels for transport is a significant contributor to global greenhouse emissions, of course, not something that I endorse on this show, I'm simply reading to you from a site. The use of biofuels has been promoted as an effective way of reducing global emissions. However, any analysis of the benefits of biofuels needs to include not just its actual use in a vehicle, but also the emissions created during the complete production cycle of that biofuel. It also needs to look at the wider economic and social picture surrounding a particular biofuel and its feedstock. Impacts on the environment. The palm oil industry is causing environmental devastation, social breakdown, health problems, and massive habitat and species loss. Greenhouse emissions. The use of palm oil-based diesel actually increases greenhouse emissions. It is estimated that the use of Southeast Asian palm oil as a feedstock for biodiesel will actually increase greenhouse gas emissions by at least 2 to 8 times more than those saved by using it as a fuel. But ladies and gentlemen, you know, there are many sources of that information, which I believe is valid. And yet, the corporatist environmental agendas simply ignore it now. It's exactly the same with CSG. Many conservationists, many Greens have come forward and said, well, actually, you know, CSG doesn't actually have a lower carbon footprint. Not interested. If only the environmental people who are involved in these causes could understand the degree to which they have actually been led by the nose and swindled. If they could perhaps come together with people in the truth movement, we could have such a huge impact, because there would be such a groundswell of people, such a large number of people who could come together. But, you know, the divide and rule, the tactics of the ruling elites, the great game, is working for them very well these days, ladies and gentlemen, when we still have this very, very sharp divide between right-wing collectivist socialist left-wing collectivist socialist environmentalists and libertarian right-wing environmental laissez-faire groups who seem to think that they need to be at each other's throats when in fact they have the same interests at heart. One of the goals, one of the long-term goals of this show is to try and bring those kind of people together. Haven't had much luck in that area so far, but it's on my list. We are going to break. I hope you found that brief little window there on biofuels interesting, and it'll be in the show notes. We'll be right back after this break. With Truth News Radio. Well, I hope you can stay with us for the second hour today, because I have a very important interview coming to you from Damascus, Syria, where we will be going through some of the dramatic and disturbing stories that I have been outlining for you in the first hour of today's show. And we will certainly be looking into the question of whether the Syrian chemical weapons attacks were in fact a staged false flag using manipulated footage of children who had perhaps been kidnapped from government-supported regions of Syria. I want to briefly cover another topic on today's show. There's a movie that came out, was produced last year, and it's titled Informant. And it is about the story of Brandon Darby, who was a one-time activist, a collectivist anarchist, who was quite influential with a lot of people in New Orleans, was involved in the Hurricane Katrina cleanup, and was kind of a mentor to a lot of younger people and activists over the years, but who actually gravitated into becoming an FBI informant. And even worse, he went into the process of what you would call COINTELPRO, where he actually helped targeted patsies to develop ideas which would then become evidence used against them, and was. And in fact, two of them went to prison for at least 4 years, 2 to 4 years, I believe. The story is quite a strange one. The movie is quite a strange movie. I wouldn't really recommend it for its documentary value. I feel it's got a somewhat propagandistic bent in it. It appears to be trying to whitewash Brandon Darby to some extent. It gives him a huge centre focus and lets him kind of, his narrative kind of direct the movie, which I think, considering the very strong evidence that this guy was duplicitous, let people down, betrayed people, entrapped them, led to one man's suicide. There is nothing good-hearted about this man. To me, he looks like someone with a personality disorder. He looks like a classic narcissist to me. But because he is actually at the centre of the movie and his narrative drives the movie, you're kind of forced to empathise with him, which is kind of sick, really. Now, however, there are some aspects of the movie which I think are worthwhile looking at. The main one I want to focus on is the way in which he was able to manipulate the younger men who joined the group and to basically cajole them into planning acts of violence, but without ever himself actually conceiving those ideas. He was able to seed them with the idea of violence and then gently encourage them towards it, or sometimes with a kind of a mocking aggression that was actually spurring them on, but not directly encouraging them. But the technique he used, I believe, it has the flavour to me. It has the feel of something that is done often, because it worked so well with these guys. And the man concerned looks like he's had some training. It looks like he was taught a little bit how to do that. Maybe he had a natural talent for it, but when he went into basically being a complete undercover FBI, I would assume that they gave him some more guidelines and he followed it. And one of the key things that he did with these men, and he was quite a bit older. He was in his mid-30s. The patsies he was grooming were in their early 20s. And one of the main things he did was he sort of provoked them into being more aggressive than they would otherwise have been by kind of mocking them. And I want to play to you a clip from the film which actually highlights that aspect of the story. So I'll just play to you a little clip here from the movie Informant. And this is one of the men who was suckered in to committing, or actually planning, never actually committing, but planning an act of aggression and involved the making of Molotov cocktails, which were never used. But this is his voice describing how Brandon Darby psychologically influenced him.
He said we needed to, like, toughen up, stop looking like we ate a bunch of tofu. To my knowledge, none of the three of us were vegetarian. I've never been a vegetarian. I'm just skinny. And I'm sorry that I don't measure up to your standard of toughness or masculinity, but, I mean, don't tell me to stop eating tofu. Like, what does that even mean? Like...
He made comments about how Brad specifically, and me too, kind of like weaklings. We weren't men's men. The coffee that I ordered, I remember one time he made fun because I ordered a latte and not like a coffee. We didn't want to just be these guys that just showed up without any credentials. That's everything that Brandon was. He was the activist guy from Austin.
Brad and David both were from working towns like Midland, similar to where I was from. I felt a sense of camaraderie with that. I could see a lot of myself in them.
Just pause it there. That's actually the voice of Brandon speaking there. Previously, you heard the voice of the two men he was actually grooming. I'll just continue.
I understood some of their anger. I really understood it, actually. David, like, he had a really rough adolescence, you know.
There was always a lot of conflict in my house. I had a lot of fear of my dad. He is a very controlling individual. I have always tried to be kind of the person who's a man. And I try to prove that I have that kind of manliness. My first real conflict with law enforcement was a protest against the KKK. That one ended pretty bad. I ended up being tased and arrested. I did not want to go be vulnerable to that situation again. If I was going to go, I wanted to have protection.
Start, you're going to need to take one of these big orange traffic barrels.
Okay, I'll just leave it there. The problem with the documentary is that it is really skewed in terms of making you identify with Brandon Darby as if he's some kind of good guy, when in fact, really, the core testimony from the people he tricked says the exact opposite. But the documentary uses a lot of interleaved audio. It continually interleaves Brandon Darby talking about it with the people that he tricked talking about it. And it's not a continuous flow, which actually really undermines your ability to think critically about what was really going on. Now, just to give you a summary of some of the details of what actually took place, after an initial experiment that he did with the FBI in which he informed on a Palestinian who he believed was involved in some nefarious activities, who later committed suicide as a result of Brandon Darby's going to the FBI. The FBI recruited him for a specific task. They actually wanted him to infiltrate the RNC, Republican National Conference, in 2008 in Minneapolis. And this was actually an operation. This was a deep cover operation of him going to Minneapolis with some of these young people and getting involved in their ideas and actually trying to encourage some of the ones he knew to come. And many of them said, look, we're not interested. But, you know, because he was an influence on them, he was a model figure to them, some of them responded. And then gradually kind of, you know, provoking them with these jibes about them not being manly enough and talking continually about, you know, what it means to be a revolutionary and what it means to take action. And, of course, he'd been to Venezuela and he'd met with people under Chavez there, and he had the aura of a man who was a bit like a Che Guevara type figure. And again, you know, that inspired these kids and made them want to do something more than they had ever done. And gradually, as the conversations continued and as they were kind of on the road talking about it, the kids themselves came up with the idea of making Molotov cocktails. Now, they don't say that he seeded them with that idea. He seeded them with the idea of doing something, of being tough men, of being real guys, you know. And one of them, I mean, these kids are stupid. Not trying to defend them. I'm not saying that they weren't also culpable, but they were stupid. But they came up with the idea of making Molotov cocktails. Now, they, in their minds, had no intention of actually hurting people with these weapons, but they were involved in, they'd seen events such as the rioting which took place in Minneapolis with some of the black-dressed anarchist protesters smashing windows, and they kind of wanted to do something. They felt like they needed to be part of it. So they had this idea of making the Molotov cocktails. And once they'd settled on that idea, Brandon Darby then basically encouraged them into it, provoked them a little more by suggesting that they weren't man enough to actually go through with it. So basically toughening them up and saying, are you really going to do it? Are you really going to do it? Someone might get hurt. How do you feel about that? Provoking them. And of course, as he was talking to them, he was wearing a wire. And all this was recorded. And then a very high-profile bust took place. They were raided in the middle of the night. And two of the guys involved ended up going to prison. One of them tried to plead that he was entrapped, but it didn't work. Unfortunately, we have run to the end of the hour. I hope you join us for the second hour. I've got a very important interview coming with a lady from Syria by the name of Sarah. Do stay with us. You're with Truth News Radio Australia.